The reading today is an excerpt from the most recent assessment from the International Panel on Climate Change. Came out in 2014, and that they're coming out with another one in a couple of years. It's the fifth, so every 5 years or so 25 years they've been doing this. And these reports are subdivided into sections, and I've read most of this report a while ago, and I've been wanting to talk to you about it. There is an easy part, it's called Summary for Policymakers, which is what they go and tell the politicians. It's very short and to the point. I want to point out that when they say things, words like extremely likely, what these scientists from the IPCC talk about is statistics. Extremely likely means it is. It doesn't mean it may not be. And that's one thing that some people have done. They've turned their words around against them when they say extremely likely in the context. Again, context is everything. We're talking about 99% possibility of happening. So it's going to happen. So there we go. Human influence on the climate system is clear, and recent anthropogenic emissions of greenhouse gases are the highest in history. Recent climate changes have had widespread impacts on human and natural systems. Warming of the climate system is unequivocal. And since the 1950s, many of the observed changes are unprecedented over decades to millennia. The atmosphere and ocean have warmed, the amount of snow and ice have diminished, and sea level has risen. Anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions have increased since the pre-industrial era, driven largely by economic and population growth, and are now higher than ever. This has led to atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide and methane, nitrous oxide that are unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. Their effects, together with those of other anthropogenic drivers, have been detected throughout the climate system and are extremely likely to have been the dominant cause of observed warming since the mid-20th century. In recent decades, changes in climate have caused impacts on natural and human systems on all continents across the oceans. Impacts are due to observed climate change, irrespective of its cause, indicating the sensitivity of natural and human systems to changing climate. Climate change will amplify existing risks and create new risks for natural and human systems. Risks are unevenly distributed and are generally greater for disadvantaged people and communities in countries at all levels of development. I want to start this morning by sharing a fact that I've become aware of only in recent times. Apparently, there exists in this day and age a flat earth movement. This is their logo. They have regular meetings, conferences, cons, if you will, and they're for real, for real. I heard some of these clearly nut jobs on a podcast, and before I realized it, unconsciously my brain turned onto scientist mode and I wanted to poke the holes in the reasoning. I mean, on the surface, what they were saying was like, okay, this falls logically from that, from the other, and the other thing. Sounded pretty tight, except they probably weren't in class that day when their physics teacher talked about frames of reference. Or if they were in class, they had questions and they never asked them. Or maybe they went to a school district where there is no physics lesson on frames of reference. The point is that it took me about 30 seconds to poke holes in this theory, which seems widely accepted, and I was able to dismantle it just like I just did. And that's because I am a scientist. I have over 30 years of experience with this kind of thinking. This is what I do all day. I look at data. I look at patterns in the data. I have had training in this method, and now it's involuntary reflex, like breathing, like sneezing, and so on. And yet, being a scientist has always made me uncomfortable. And I might add, and it took me until I was writing the sermon to figure out why. The short thing of it is because scientists know how the sausage is made, but we're also made of the very same sausage. Okay? So this month's theme is nature. My perspective on nature has been forged by my journey into becoming the scientist I am today, which is a person who uses the scientific method to make a living. That's what I do. I draw my paycheck because I look at data. Today, being a scientist is no longer what it used to be in the 18th and 19th century, before or at the start of the Industrial Revolution. Back in those days, scientists were called natural philosophers. And today, being a scientist does not equate being a natural philosopher, but scientists are portrayed as those saviors or mad scientists. You know, that's a whole another thing that I'm not going to talk about today. But being a scientist today is not really as glamorous as advertised. Being a scientist today means being a brain in service of capitalism. Yes, I said it, capitalism. So where does that leave the question of how humans relate to nature? This is the theme of the month. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to unpack this by telling you a little bit about my journey as a scientist. I don't know how relatable this is to other scientists, but this is mine, and it helped me to see some things. I don't know when I first realized I was a scientist. I was, as a child, children are always curious about what makes the world tick, right? But it wasn't until high school that I firmed up the subject was gonna be Earth. This Earth that we stand on, where I come from, there's a lot of earthquakes and they make people really nervous. And if you've ever been in an earthquake, I know they happen here, but not with that much frequency. It's unsettling, and you want to know why is this happening, and why is this happening to us, and how can we tell, can we predict? And so I thought, knowing how the earth works, knowing where rocks came from, knowing about fossils, tectonic plates, would help. I wanted to help humanity by understanding. So I went off to study geology in one of the best places in the world to study geology, Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is a picture of near Lake Louise. I don't remember precisely where. And please note that at this point, in my mind, I still was a natural philosopher. I wanted to know for knowledge's sake. I was like Lavoisier or Descartes. These are 18th century scientists that had nothing better to do than poke around and find out things. I was curious. And being a geology student, I sure learned how the Earth works, but it didn't take very long for me to realize that of all the scientific disciplines, perhaps geology is the one that is the most obviously connected to human exploitation of natural resources. Oil, petroleum, coal, natural mineral deposits, gold. You could have a very lucrative summer job as an undergraduate student in Calgary in the late 80s if you made A's. because there are a lot of companies looking for geologists, aspiring geologists, and they would give you research projects to do. So that is me and my boss in yellow with a miner in front of a gold mine in central British Columbia. And it's called the Black Dome Mine, and it's now closed, but I've been in a gold mine. But that felt weird, okay? Like that summer, where I went into the mine, and we're about to go there, I started to sense a barrier between me and nature. And I'll talk more about this in a minute, but the impetus was to retreat. I'm not into planet exploitation. I just want to learn. I just want to help. So I dropped exploration geology from my senior level classes and started thinking, what can I do to help? So the one thing that I'm still to this day very fond of, the one thing that humans cannot really destroy or exploit are volcanoes. They destroy and exploit humans. They don't, but not the other way around. So I decided to pursue a master's degree in volcanology. And again, it didn't take me long to figure out, but that's sort of like, this path leads to me being a professor teaching other people to exploit the earth. No. I wanted to be more helpful than that. After all, scientists are meant to understand the world to help humanity, no? So when the opportunity came to switch to chemistry, I took it because it seemed worthy, because better living through chemistry. Am I right? Most chemists will tell you that chemistry is the central science, and I am a chemist, so also I would agree. I thought I would have a lot of opportunity to be helpful. And I know I don't want to get too technical, but what I ended up studying for my dissertation is the movement of electrons in these big molecules that are sometimes used to make plastics. It was a form of fundamental research, but it was based on solving a problem for industry, for the industrial world. My PhD advisor got funding for me so I wouldn't have to teach, I wouldn't have to be a TA. He got a grant from National Science Foundation, and he got a grant from the Petroleum Research Fund. Let's let that sink in. You can run, but you can't hide. I thought I escaped exploitation of the earth by changing topics, and I was still deep in it. And to top it all, despite wanting to help, my sense of separation grew bigger from nature. Like, I just, I think I know why that happens now. I understand my discomfort about feeling separate from nature. I don't think it's a bad thing to try to help humans with science. I don't. I still try. The problem is that when one studies nature, one tends to objectify nature. So it's me looking in from the outside. The smaller you go, so you start with a rock, and in a rock it's pretty relatable, but then you look at a molecule, smaller it goes, more separation you need. So when we look at nature as an object, sometimes we need separation also psychologically. It's hard to study things that are us, are around us, or we are standing on. But don't get me wrong. At this point, it's like, I don't want you to say, she's going to say science is bad and go back to the flat earth thing. No. Science is necessary. The scientific method always works. And we must use it. Otherwise, we'll all get, like the flat earthers. What I don't like is the way that today is used for economic gain all the time practical solutions. Today, even fundamental science is applied science. There is no such thing as natural philosophy anymore, and everything, if you look hard enough, is for the purpose of making money. Take it from me, I know what I'm talking about, and this is the disconnect. Men outside of nature for the buck. So I mentioned Lavoisier in passing a minute ago. He was a scientist in the 18th-ish century. He was a chemist in France. One of Lavoisier's students, before he emigrated to Delaware, was Eleuther Irénée, we call him E.I., Dupont de Nemours. He was a chemist, and he was the founding father of the company that is known as DuPont today. They make basically plastics and coatings, and seeds, and enzymes. If you have a carpet in your house, it's probably, they make textiles. In the early 19th century, DuPont used to make gunpowder. And E.I. DuPont learned about gunpowder from Lavoisier because Lavoisier, as his teacher, said, hey, that's an interesting thing to look into. Not because he wanted to make a buck, because Lavoisier was one of those 18th century people that just liked to look at nature. But DuPont was emigrating into the United States and he needed to make a buck, and he's like, hey, wait a minute, gunpowder, I can make it better. We know science. So DuPont and his descendants made a lot of money from this interesting field of scientific study. Enough money to buy wide swaths of lands in Delaware, New Jersey, to protect the trees. This is Longwood Gardens in Delaware. It was part of the DuPont family gardens. If you go to Longwood, it's beautiful. There is a greenhouse, there's trees of everything. They have all kinds of things. It's marvelous. They made enough money to protect the trees from decay, to plant new things, to, you know, which is kind of ironic if you follow, you know, environmental kerfuffles, like the whole chlorofluorocarbon stuff that happened to DuPont in the early 20th century. But I digress. The reason I'm bringing this connection between DuPont and Lavoisier is because, to me, that is emblematic of how science has moved in the past, 200-ish years, from thirst for knowledge to thirst for practical solutions for humans for money. And in my opinion, practical solutions for money are what disconnect people from nature. After my doctorate, I just about had enough of exploiting the earth. On the suggestion of a friend, I decided to apply my skills to the renewable fuels industry, which I kind of still do to this day. In a way, I felt like that this was my atonement for being a geologist, chemist, earth exploiter. And at this point, I really, really, really wanted to help. So biofuels are helpful. I'm a chemist. I can do this. Let's go. If I help make biofuels, I'm helping nature. Ha! Okay. Except the size of the biofuel industry today is really small. It's inversely proportional to the size of the oil industry, which is pretty big. It can't grow that much more because of political reason. So everything is made of petroleum. Drugs are made of petroleum, you know. Liquid transportation fuels are made of petroleum, plastics, and so on. So the field of discovery could be bigger, but it isn't because of political reason. But there's another thing. In order to make products that are renewable and can compete with oil, scientists like me, scientists including me, are tasked with modifying natural processes to make these materials. Make them cheap enough and fast enough that they're competitive. And I hate to say this in front of Spiral and all of you all, you guys, okay? But these processes, these modifications always involve molecular biology, which means you're messing with the DNA of a plant or an animal. Always. You don't get stuff that comparable to what has been sitting underground for millions of years if you don't alter their DNA. You can't evolve that fast. Oil is very old. If you want to make a comparable thing now, like this, genetic modification. So, it's either use oil and exploit the Earth's resources, or modify the Earth's resources. Am I nature, or am I outside of it? I have a story. In my geology days, in those times of lucrative and exploitative summer jobs that I was talking about a minute ago, I spent 4 months in central British Columbia. This is what it looks like from an old slide, 1988. Prospecting and surveying, prospecting for perlite deposits. If you garden, you know that perlite is a thing you use for potted plants, because it's a nutrient and it also absorbs water, so you don't have to water the plants as much. If you are into the remediation industry and clean oil spills, you know that perlite is used to clean oil spills. It has many uses. It's a nice little mineral, a volcanic glass. It's volcanic, and it's pretty. Anyway, during that summer, I was so physically close to nature, but I felt really emotionally detached from it. Not because of any philosophical reasoning, but because when I got hired, I was told I had to carry a shotgun to shoot at bears if we encountered any. And so my thoughts were consumed by bear encounters and what to do in case of a bear encounters. I had to remember that grizzlies don't climb trees, black bears do, run, there's a flare, don't, you know, roll over and play dead, know the difference between bears, stay downwind, where's the wind, I don't know. I was scared every day as we made our way in really steep terrain. This doesn't show the steep terrain, I had to choose between slides, but it was really steep terrain that not even like mountain goats would go to, with a 40-pound pack. All I could think about wasn't the beauty of nature surrounding me. It's like, oh, I hope I don't get eaten today. I hope I don't see a bear. I hope I don't have to shoot the bear. So one day we stopped for lunch on the slope of a valley that was similar to this picture. And from this slope, we see hundreds of heads of cattle and buffalo mix. They're called beefalo. They're like cows bred with cattle. And dogs and a man on a horse following behind the cattle. It was like that scene in The Lion King, except, you know, nobody died and it was in Canada. After the cattle passed through, this man on the horse, we wanted to make, my boss and I, we wanted to make ourselves known because we were surveying that land that he was in, and maybe it was his or his, you know, just to let them know we were here. It's always a good thing to do when you're in the middle of nowhere. Honestly, there was no one there. And besides, you know, we'd been together, my boss and I, for 3 months, and after a while you exhaust your conversational repartee. So we started talking. I noticed he was riding an interesting saddle with designs, but the thing that really caught my attention is that this ranch hand cattle herder, whatever you want, cowboy, had no gun, no shotgun on his pack. And like, because my mind was all full of bear, I'm like, I asked him, aren't you afraid of being mauled by bears? What if they get your cattle? What if they get your dogs? Aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid? And he looks at me And maybe I should have told you that this man, before I started this, he was clearly a First Nation person, and I don't know what the name of the tribe was, but he was working in this, it wasn't a reservation, but it's near, so. So I'm asking him, "I, why aren't you afraid?" And he said, "We're all part of nature. Me, the bear, the dogs, we're part of nature. Me getting mauled by the bear is part of nature. I accept this." He turned around and rode away. This really happened. I wish I could say that helped my fears of bear. It did not help my fears of bear. I'm still to this day afraid of bears. But it did give me a broader view of nature. So now I'm going to invite you to consider with an open mind the thought that anything that involves humans, everything man-made, good or bad, garbage or penicillin, is also part of nature. This building, the Madonna mic, the batteries, all part of nature. No more or less than a beehive or a beaver dam, anything like that. Humans are no different than a leaf or a bear. Nature takes all of it, the good with the bad. We are part of nature. What we make is part of nature. We're animals with a big brain as an evolutionary advantage over other animals. But we're not very robust. This guy is very robust. We're not. It's super cute. This animal can travel through space. Humans use very complex ways of traveling through space, and they're not really good at it. This guy can hop on a piece of meteorite and go, right? We, unlike the tardigrade, we can only survive in about 30 degrees centigrade, okay? I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit. I refuse to learn that. But we humans are only good between 10 and 40 degrees centigrade without clothes, right? We need clothes, we need air conditioning, we're prone to illness, our flesh is soft, our skulls are thin, very thin. Evolutionary, to make room for our big brain, the skull needed to be thinner. But the big brain we have is the only evolutionary advantage. We can think better than the other animals. We have ideas, all right? We can use tools better than the other primates. I'm not saying the other primates cannot use tools, but we're better. And that's all we use to make the world a better place for our species, all right? So air conditioning, heating, HVAC in general, clothing, cars, remote controls. We do all this in order to survive, to keep the species going. But sadly or ironically, when we start doing this in a very complex way with our big brain, we start feeling separate from it. It's really hard for humans to feel connected. The cattle rancher that talked to me that day was showing me the seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. A part. We're not the center of the part. We are a part, like a leaf, like every grain of sand. If you realize this, then there is no separation between us and nature. We realize that we invented this separation because we thought it would help us, but it's not helping us. We think we're doing good, but we're destroying our very basis for survival. And we're taking down collateral damage as we do so. We're taking down the bees and the whatevers, the frogs, not the tardigrade. What we need to see ourselves connected to the rest of nature, what we need is being humble. Reminding ourselves every day that there is no difference between us and a leaf. Really, no. And if you go down, and I hope I remember this correctly, I work with yeast a lot, and they have done a study that 50% of the DNA in yeast is also found in humans. We are 50% similar to yeast. Okay, we have evolved from unicellular organisms. We are part of that. We are 60% like a cow, 90% like a rat, 98% like a chimpanzee. Okay? We are part of nature. So I want to circle back quickly to the reading from the IPCC. The last bit said, climate change will amplify existing risks and create new risks for natural and human systems. We have created the situation of elevated greenhouse gases, but it's not the first time the Earth has had elevated greenhouse gases. Everything is recycled on Earth. There have been cycles of heightened greenhouse gases in several times in the Earth's 4.53 billion years. However, the Earth doesn't care. I wanted to entitle the sermon, "The Earth Doesn't Care," but I didn't want to give away the punchline. The Earth doesn't care because the Earth and nature does not care about the same thing as we humans as a singular species care about. Our species' survival, that's a biological thing. So other species may stick around. New species can take our niche. This happens all the time. Other relationships between, its symbiotic relationships will form. The Earth does not care. You know what this is? This is a picture taken recently of Chernobyl. All right? This is nature encroaching in a place that was destroyed by humans because of, oops, mistake. But you know, we humans with the big brains, we make mistakes. But see, the vegetation encroaches, the plants grow, and we can't eat them because they're still kind of radioactive. We can't really live there. There's circles where you could still live or not. But nature, life goes on. Nature goes on. The Earth doesn't care. The 1 degree centigrade overall increase in global temperature in the last 20 years is now part of nature. And it is affecting us mostly, our ecological niche, our survival as a species. It's harder to survive. It's harder for poor people in Bangladesh to survive. All right? So what can we do? We can save the environment, right? What environment are we saving? We're saving our environment because this one, this is an environment too. It's unfriendly to humans, you know? Keep in mind that the environment we want to change is our own environment. But how do we do it? Do we become shrill and fire and brimstone-y like I'm doing right now? Do we march? Do we recycle? Do we buy Priuses? Yes. And. Remember, we are saving the environment for all of the human species. And so, to do it effectively, we don't need to care just for nature as an outside of us concept, but we need the sixth UU principle. We need the goal, a world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We need, to save the environment and ourselves, we need to love each other like our lives depended on it, because they really do. So may it be. All right, so the last hymn, or song, is another attempt at All right. I have to do this from my iPod. This is a song by Talking Heads, and I've shortened it up a bit because it's like 6 minutes long and nobody wants to be, and then we have food and coffee. I want you to join in. David Byrne is going to be leading the singing. We can sing, sway. Please rise up as you're willing and able and do it.
Now it's only fields and trees.
Where is the town now?
It's nothing but flowers.
The flowers and cars
were sacrificed for agriculture.
Now the breeze not over.
But I guess I was wrong.
Once there were parking lots, now it's a peaceful oasis.
You got it, you got it.
This was a Pizza Hut,
now it's all covered with daisies.
You got it, you got it.
I miss the honky tonks, Dairy Queens and 7-Elevens.
You got it, you got it.
And as things fell apart, nobody paid much attention.
Okay, so yeah, it ends abruptly. What am I gonna do? So, yay. So, we extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth, the community, or the fire commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. I have a real quick benediction, and then I wanna leave it to Spiral to play the postlude. May we all find the ability to find joy and strength, not in the strident call to arms, but in stretching our arms to grasp our fellow creatures in the striving for justice and truth. Go in peace.
This is where you walk out, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, or okay. You can stay.
Okay.
I've been walking in my sleep, counting troubles, did a counting sheep where the years went. I can't say, I just turned around and they rolled away. It's gone away. Yesterday, and now I find myself on the mountainside, where the rivers change direction across the Great Divide. Well, I've been sifting through the layers of dusty books and faded papers. They tell a story I used to know. It was one that happened so long ago. And it's gone away. Yesterday, and now I find myself on the mountainside. It's where the rivers change directions across the Great Divide. Last night I heard the owl calling as softly as the night was falling, with a question, and I replied. But she's gone across the borderline. She's gone away. Yesterday, and now I find myself on the mountainside. Where am I? It's where the rivers change direction across the Great Divide. The finest hour that I have seen is the one that comes between the edge of night and the break of day. That's when the darkness rolls away. Final chorus. And it's gone away. Yesterday, and now I find myself on the mountainside. It's where the rivers change direction across the Great Divide.